Hey, this is Aaron Carnes. We started this podcast in 2021 to promote my book, In Defense of Ska. Since then, the podcast has grown into its own thing. I've been working on an expanded second edition. I interviewed new people, edited every chapter, and there's a new final chapter, 30,000 new words. The expanded second edition of In Defense of Ska will be released on October 29th, 2024. Can you do something for me? Pre-order it right now at clashbooks.com under the Books tab. The more copies it sells in advance, the more it'll get people to support ska music. Thanks.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Consequence Podcast Network. Welcome to In Defense of Ska. We aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of the music. Ska deserves the respect genres like punk, hip-hop, and hardcore find among their listeners. Our host is renowned music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska, Aaron Carnes.
Today we talk about a band that was highly influential on many 90s ska bands, Mr. Bungle. Though they weren't a ska band, there was plenty of ska in their music, and their chaotic approach to the music influenced the direction many bands would play ska in the 90s and beyond. To talk about the band, we have Mr. Bungle's bassist, Trevor Dunn. Mr. Bungle was formed in Eureka, California in 1985. They are known for playing every style of music. In the early years, ska was a prominent part of the mix. We dive deep into the band's early years in the 80s, playing small clubs and releasing DIY cassette tapes, all of it leading up to their self-titled 1991 debut record, which was on the major label Warner Brothers. It's an amazing and incredibly well-produced album, which is odd considering just how bizarre and non-commercial the album was. At the time, Mr. Bungle lead singer Mike Patton was also fronting Faith No More. They had blown up with their rap rock hit Epic. Warner Brothers probably never imagined that the Mr. Bungle record would gain a sizable audience. They were probably most concerned with making sure that Faith No More stayed happy. But the Mr. Bungle record and their other records have done well. That first Mr. Bungle record has a couple of the weirdest ska songs from the 90s. And now joining me is my co-host, veteran ska musician Adam Davis, of the bands Link 80 and Omnigon.
So Mr. Bungle was a big thing for you in high school, right?
Yeah, you know, I didn't really think about this much until I was working on my book, but before I actually knew what ska was, before I went to that first Skank and Pickle show and made the connection that this is a genre, I was a big fan of Fishbone, and I was a huge fan of that first Mr. Bungle record.
Yeah, and a lot of those early ska bands that we used to see in the South Bay definitely had a Mr. Bungle vibe. Like they were definitely into like the weirder stuff.
Janitors Against Apartheid, One Eye Open. Later you have Jeff Rosenstock's first band, Arrogant Sons of Bitches. Mm-hmm. And then I don't know if Blue Meanies were directly influenced by Mr. Bungle, but I always kind of saw similarities in sort of their approach to music and how ska was this sort of thing that existed within all these genres and sort of the chaotic vibe. That was the thing. It's like when I listened to that first record, like, I didn't realize, I just thought it was like, this is crazy music. That's how I interpreted it as a kid. I didn't realize that, oh, in this song here, they're playing a genre known as ska. And this genre has all these bands doing it. It just blew my mind.
Yeah, a lot of 90s ska bands approach ska as something chaotic. And maybe it was misinterpreted as fun or goofy. But I think a lot of this vibe stemmed from Mr. Bungle, who, above all else, knew how to make music sound unsettling.
I think a good place to start would be talking about Fishbone.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a good place. Yeah. Definitely. You guys saw them in like what, 1986?
That's a good question. I know we were all into that first EP that they put out, which I don't remember what year that was. Yeah. It might've been.
The first EP was 85, I think. So this would have been right after that.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I remember I went down, I think I was like 16, so that must have been like 84, maybe. And my dad took me and my girlfriend down to Palo Alto to see. It was actually Fishbone opening up for the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Oh, wow.
And also this local band called Dot 3, which I ended up really loving. Really weird band.
Oh, I remember them, yeah, because I used to live in San Jose for a long time, and I know that guy, Kenny, the leader of that band, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The bass player played like a Chapman stick, and drummer kind of had a weird percussion set up. And anyway, Fishbone stole the night for sure. And to this day, one of the best live bands I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And then for some reason, they were one of the few bands who would stop in Eureka and play, probably on their way up to Portland or back down to LA or something. And there was a place in Eureka called the Old Town Barn Grill where a lot of bands played. And they would come by, you know, once a year or something, and we would always be there, and ended up kind of hanging out with a couple of them sometimes. And I remember we gave Angelo our first demo, The Raging Wrath, and he later told us that he used to listen to that while he was writing lyrics. We're like, what? How do you, what? And so, but yeah, they were a huge influence on us, and that they were probably the reason, one of the reasons I would say that we kind of, I mean, when we were playing metal, we were listening to a lot of different kinds of music and exploring other things, you know, as, you know, composers or whatever you want to call it. But, they were one of the bands who kind of inspired us to add a horn section, you know, add a couple horns and start, you know, and getting into ska. I mean, there were a lot of other bands too that we were into. Oingo Boingo was a big one.
Yeah.
I think, Bad Manners we were really into. They were supposed to play up there once and their bus broke down and they didn't make it. So, but they did. I did see the Skodlites that night. They were the opening band and they ended up playing anyway, I think. So, which is cool.
So Eureka in the 80s, like there really was not a lot of bands routed through there.
Not a lot. Yeah. Not every once in a while, someone kind of big would come through and play at the university. But even like jazz groups, you know, it was rare. I mean, I saw some great stuff when I was in college up there, like, Art Ensemble of Chicago came through, and, Chick Corea came through one year, you know, but it was kind of rare. It was like a big event for any of those bands or, you know, rock bands. Like I think Cheap Trick played up there, at the university once, but there still aren't any big rock venues in Eureka at all. They're really small venues, you know? So, yeah, most bands don't have any reason to go there.
So the first tape came out, in, I think like 85, The Raging Wrath of the Easter Bunny.
Yeah.
And it's very metal. Like you're saying, there is like a little bit of ska on the song, Hypocrites.
Right. Yeah. We're hypocrites.
And then, okay, when you guys re-recorded it, you did not include that.
Right, right. So we kind of, you know, the whole point of redoing The Raging Wrath was to like kind of, you know, embrace this 80s metal thing. And that song and the song Evil Satan were both kind of joke songs. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Patton wrote, and I put quotes around it, the song Hypocrites, but you know, all the stuff after the couple first metal riffs is all, you know, it's like a jam band thing, and then it goes into some like BS ska thing. It's just like generic, you know, derivative joke music, basically.
Yeah, and
it was sort of I think in retrospect, it was like intended as sort of like a humorous contrast to the quote unquote serious metal that was happening. You know, all of it we took with a, you know, was kind of tongue in cheek in a way, even though we've always been a band we're very serious about what we do, but it's also, there's always this tongue in cheek element to it. And I think mostly just because we don't take ourselves too seriously. You know, we're like, it's just music, folks.
Yeah. So the first record, I'm sorry, the first tape.
Yeah.
You guys, Trey recorded it. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. He had a Tascam or a Fostex 4-track tape recorder, you know? And, I think we set up 2 microphones in the garage where we used to rehearse. And then he went in later and we overdubbed the vocals and the guitar solos and added a couple of little things here and there. But yeah, none of us really, he barely knew what he was doing and none of us had any idea what, you know, how to record. So that was our most like, you know, professional, attempt at recording.
Oh yeah. One other question about the re-recording of the first tape, is that you guys got Rhea Perlman on in there to do a spoken part.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So how did that happen?
The original tape, has the spoken part is from a Walt, it's like a Walt Disney, Halloween, sound effects record. It's kind of a semi-famous record that a lot of us had, probably in like the 70s really, where, you know, there's this person narrating these, these stories, and there's all these sound effects of like, you know, people being attacked by cats or, you know, storm sounds, ghost sounds. And there's this long intro and which we used on the, on the tape. And we wanted to, you know, recreate that, but we didn't want to deal with trying to get the rights to sample it. 'Cause it's a long, you know, it's like probably over a minute long. So we can't really just sample that. So Patton over the years has become friends with Danny DeVito.
Okay.
I'm not really sure how that happened. I think that, Danny's son got him into Fantomas and brought his dad to a Fantomas show. I remember meeting him in the early 2000s in LA somewhere and like, oh yeah, there's Danny DeVito. That's weird.
It's weird, but it kind of makes sense in a way.
Yeah. So him and Danny and Patton are friends now. And so he had, access to Rita and asked her to do it and she was happy to do it. And so, yeah. And we were really, I mean, that's, you know, in Bungle fashion that just adds to the weirdness of the whole thing, you know?
Sure.
Like who are some of the least metal people you could think of?
Exactly. Yeah. So your second tape, do you pronounce it Bowel of Chili?
We always call it Bowel of Chili.
Bowel of Chili. Okay.
Which is a very ridiculous adolescent, habit we had of, we'd go into like a Denny's late at night in Eureka, to get coffee and food. And we got into this thing of ordering the food just to mess with the waitress, just mispronouncing all, you know, the items. And so instead of a bowl of chili, we'd order a bowl of chili, you know, and see how she would react to that.
nice. Yeah.
So that became the title, that demo was really, like by definition, really, like a demo. It wasn't meant for, we never sold that one. It was meant to, a cassette that we could send out to promoters and venues to try and get gigs. Like there was never, I don't think there was a cover for it or anything. We just, and it had a few different iterations too. There was a really long version that had all the songs we were writing at that time. And then there was like a pared down one. And then we recorded some new songs and like added those. So it was, you know, it was kind of a, like all our other tapes back then, were more like our idea of making records, you know, with what little money we had to go into whatever studio.
Yeah, so this is the Bowel of Chili is pretty different than the first tape.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
All over the place stylistically, funk, ska, metal, the whole, you know, everything.
Yeah.
was this a fast change or was it sort of a gradual shift?
I think it was gradual because, you know, by the time that the first cassette Raging Wrath came out, we had, you know, we were already doing different stuff live. You know, we were playing like, I don't know, Run DMC songs live and you know, covers of stuff that wasn't metal at all and starting to write more melodically and I think probably by the time that Raging Wrath came out, we were already writing that stuff, you know. And then that was around the time we just decided our drummer Jed at the time wasn't really you know, he was mostly a metal guy or rock guy, so we kind of wanted someone who was a little more had a little more diverse flavor, and that's when we met this guy Hans, who's the drummer on like the next, like that damn Ballad Chile and Goddamn It, I Love America.
So the first tape, though, another thing I'm curious about is the first tape you had released by was it Lad Frith?
Yeah,
like local label, right? And then, but the rest of the tapes you just released yourself, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Lad Frith. So who were they? I know they were like local guys. They had a local band.
Yeah, it was, that was, that ended up not going well. It was, that was a couple that had a, they were kind of like a noise duo. Mm-hmm. You know, there was definitely like in the 70s and 80s, there was kind of a punk scene in Arcata and up, you know, which is a small town where the university is located just north of Eureka. And, you know, there were a lot of weird kind of like, you know, yeah, punk bands and like college radio type bands or whatever, alternative rock when alternative rock was actually alternative. And so they kind of, I think we put out the cassette ourselves, and then they kind of said, "Hey, we'll you know, put this out under our you know, as our label," which they did. And then I don't know. Then they started to like selling it in places without our knowledge, and I can't really remember what happened, but it didn't end well, and we ended up kind of like disengaging from them. So but it wasn't like they were really, I think we found out we were in San Francisco, and we went to the Tower Records on Columbus Street that used to be there, and saw our cassette being sold, you know, and we're like, hey, we didn't like authorize this, you know, and we kind of, yeah, they were, I think, selling on the side for their own benefit, but I'm not sure why they wanted to put that out in the first place. It's not like, I mean, we were selling those tapes for $5, you know.
They need their cut of that five.
Yeah, probably four sometimes.
Yeah,
but I mean, it was very, you know, very small town thing relationship, and you know, I think we signed some paper that said they would distribute it for us or something. But yeah.
So you went from the small label to self-releasing a bunch of tapes to Warner Brothers.
Yeah. Yeah. We, after when Mike got, you know, went off to join this band that nobody had ever heard of called Faith No More. And we were basically still a garage band. We were hardly even playing outside of Eureka, you know, a couple shows here and there, maybe in San Francisco. But, you know, he went off and then came back 2 years later and was like this mega rock star, you know, and then we're like, hey, we want to try to put out our music too, you know. And so we started shopping around, and we actually had some interest from this label called In Effect, which I think they put out 24/7 Spies, which was kind of like a sort of like a watered down version of a Living Color or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they were kind of interested for a minute, but then for whatever reason that didn't take. And then Patton was basically like telling, you know, his manager at Slash Records or whatever, Well, it was, I guess it was, were they in Reprise or something, or was it actually Warner Brothers? I don't remember, but
I thought it was Slash.
Yeah, maybe it was Slash, which was part of the Warner family. He was, but anyway, he basically told him, like, look, I'm going to, if you don't let me put out this, you know, band, Mr. Bungle, I'm going to walk. And he kind of had him by the balls, actually, because they, you know, he made that band, you know. And so they were like, okay, look, well, you can put out your record, but it has to be in the Warner family. And we're like, great. So we kind of thought it was going to be on Slash or Reprise or something. And then when the record actually came out, we saw it, the label said Warner Brothers. We're like, what the fuck?
I mean, the funny thing is that that is the most insane major label record of that time period. But I think it did fine. I'm sure they, it didn't hurt the label at all.
Yeah. I think you know, after years, it finally, they probably recouped the advance they gave us, you know, but it took a while. But I think they sort of, the only reason they kept us on there, you know, was because they thought they might get another Faith No More type of hit or something, which, mm-hmm. you know, we knew that wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, it's funny because Faith No More, yeah, they came out the gate with Epic, you know, being such a massive hit.
Yeah.
But they ended up sort of like finding a nice position as well, where they're like, we're kind of a weird rock band and right. we have this core crowd that digs us and we're not a hit making band anymore.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Back to your second tape. So there's an early version of Carousel on there.
Yeah.
Was that the first song that you wrote where you approached ska a little more seriously?
Probably. That's Trey's song. I wish he was here to talk about that, but yeah, I think, that's probably true. I mean, we were experimenting with a bunch of stuff and, you know, when I think back to that demo, Battle of Chile, I mean, a lot of it is garbage. You know, it's just like these sort of blues forms or, you know, just us trying to write songs that where we didn't really know how to write songs. I mean, we were coming from a metal standpoint, which was like, you know, riff after riff, you know, all riff based. And then just like, how does this riff fit in the next one? It wasn't like, what's a form of a song, you know, what's AABA or whatever. So I think, you know, a lot of those songs are way overdone, you know, or they're way too long or they just don't get the point across or something. But I think, yeah, I think you're right. That song Carousel was Trey's composition. And I think it, for us, it was, yeah, it had that ska element that, but also the compositional element that made more sense.
Yeah. Cause I mean the main riff, with the horn line, I mean, that's a good original ska jam.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like you're saying with Hypocrites, like that was like clearly done like jokey.
Yeah.
Like not like, let's write a cool part. Like, but Carousel has that from the beginning. So you could see a shift in terms of like, well, let's, and it sounds like like the way you guys write too. Like the horn line is weird, but weird in a good way.
Yeah. And you know, Trey and I were, Trey and I met in high school in a music theory class, which is kind of unheard of these days to have a music theory class in high school, you know, so we were both learning about, you know, how harmony works and stuff, and immediately started applying that to Mr. Bungle, you know, and that's why, you know, writing for other instruments like saxophones, you know, and was interesting to us. And then also, you know, it's funny, I was thinking about this, like the there's not really a lot to relate between metal and ska, except that there is something, this the driving upbeat, which is a main, which mm-hmm. is a staple of ska, it's pushing the music rhythmically, it's pushing it forward. I kind of relate that to the snare drum in metal, you know, the 2 and 4 in metal, which is, you know, it's this driving thing that's just like you're constantly, it's uplifting, you're constantly on the upbeat, you know, pushing you forward. I think that maybe that's why it appealed to us. I'm not really sure.
Yeah, and they are both rhythmic styles of music, you know.
Yeah,
different, but you know they have that element to it. I agree.
Yeah,
but you know there hasn't been a ton of crossover between metal and ska. Right. There's been some, but you know. So. When you guys start putting out your own tapes, you guys are selling them, and you're selling them like through mail order, right? Especially as we get further into the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah. We just, I don't really remember how we did it with, God damn it. I Love America. I mean, we'd take them to shows and stuff and, you know, we'd go to local record stores or, you know, if we went to some town, if we went to Portland or something, we would find a record store there and try to sell them 5 tapes, you know, and yeah, just meeting friends over through mail. I guess there were some magazines like Maximum Rock and Roll and just local fanzines that people had where you could, you know, advertise your tape. And I ended up making friends. I was kind of dealing with all that. I ended up making, well, me and Patton were both doing that. So we ended up making friends with people all over the States and actually different parts of the world too. But, you know, I met this guy in Toronto who I didn't know. And I'm like, hey, can I send you like 10 cassettes and you can take them down to the record store? And he's like, sure. And, you know, so I mailed them to him. And then, you know, a couple months later, he sends me, you know, $40, you know, in cash, you know, in an envelope, you know. So just this crazy element of trust and you know, I guess camaraderie in a way. And I'm still friends with that guy. It's crazy. And so, there's a couple people like that who I still know that, you know, helped promote the band essentially. Cause that's the only way we knew how to do it.
The networks that you were selling these tapes or the people you were meeting, these sort of scenes, were you, during that time, were you more connected to, was it like the punk side or metal side or sort of weird noise, or was it sort of all of the above?
I guess it was essentially metal. We had, again, talking about Portland, we had friends up in Portland, this band, Wehrmacht, you know, these young guys who had this, you know, death metal band. And then there were some offshoot bands. They had, there was a band called Spastic Blur. And, I think they had a ska, I don't know if it was a ska band, but there was a band called Sweaty Nipples. And, there was like, you know, rotating cast of musicians that, you know, this very, insular scene, you know, of different bands sharing members and stuff. And we would go up there and hang out with those guys. And there was some, you know, we would end up getting on some like split tapes, you know, where they'd put, you know, a different band on side B and, or doing like a split, 7-inch or something with metal bands. And, Rancid Decay is a name that comes to mind. I think that was a band from up there somewhere. All this is kind of blurring me, but yeah. Patton was definitely kind of connecting with people in that scene. And he worked at a record store in Eureka too, so he had access to like addresses and stuff, you know, and he was pretty aggressive about reaching out to people and trying to get gigs at a certain point. I mean, this is before he was in Faith No More. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there, I mean, other than that, there wasn't really, you know, we played with local bands in the Bay Area, and then we started like opening up for Primus and, you know, bands in the kind of the funk metal scene in the Bay Area, like Limbomaniacs and
it
was a lot of bands we played with down there. We were just, you know, tried to get on bills with these bands. We ended up there was a woman who worked for Dave Lefkowitz, who was Primus's manager, and that was Kristen Yee, and she ended up becoming our manager. You know, she was kind of trying to get her foot in the door managing bands, and I guess she saw us play, and I think she had a crush on Patton. So, so she kind of helped us like get in the door with opening up for those bands, for like Primus, you know.
I was a teenager. I lived in Gilroy.
Oh yeah.
And I was starting to hear about funk metal, you know, but this is before I was even old enough to go to shows. Uh-huh. And you know, I really liked Primus a lot, and I was hearing about all these bands, and that was my context to first hearing about Mr. Bungle, was you were part of this funk metal scene.
Right, right. Which we never really were. I mean, we kind of got lumped in there partly because we were playing with those bands, but we never really considered, and we still get called a funk metal band. But, you know, we never called ourselves that, you know. I mean, we sort of did in that, like, basically in the Ballad Chiley days, we're like, what do we, you know, I remember we had one of our flyers advertising our new tape was like, we called it Funkadelic Thrashing Circus Ska.
Those were the days, you know, say as many genres as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. Just throw them all in there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think too, like what's interesting is that, when I got really into ska in the early 90s, and but before I got into ska or understood the name ska, I was a big fan of your first record, and I was a big fan of Fishbone, but I didn't understand that those parts were ska.
Right.
It wasn't until like later I, you know, started getting to ska that I'd be like, oh, wait a minute. Yeah.
Yeah.
That Bungle record and Fishbone, they were playing this type of music in there.
Yeah. 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 You know, up in Arcata, they had, it's defunct now, but they had, the college up there had a radio station, KHSU, and which I listened to a lot. And I got into a lot of bands through that radio station, and Oingo Boingo is one of them. I remember they played a version of, Ain't This the Life, which was, I don't know if it was a demo version or something, but it's not the version that's on the record. It's kind of more aggressive or something. And it's just so high energy and weird. I mean, that was, and me and Train Mike were all super into Oingo Boingo, you know. We actually covered sort of one of their deep cuts at one point, that song, Pictures of You, which isn't really even a ska song. It's kind of this weird ballady thing. Maybe it does kind of have a ska element, but aside from Fishbone, I think Oingo Boingo had a big influence on us. Ironically, or just by nature or just natural sequence of things, we ended up, a guy we became friends with, Willie Winant, who's a classical percussion player in the Bay Area. We met him through John Zorn. He ended up going on tour with us, and he's on Disco Volante and California, still active teacher and performer in the Bay Area. And he actually played in the original version of the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He was like, he went to Cal Arts and was friends with Danny Elfman and yeah. So that was kind of interesting.
So during the 80s, before you had released the album, were you familiar with any other like US ska bands besides Fishbone, or, you know, Oingo Boingo has ska elements? Were you familiar with any of the US ska bands?
That's a good question. Name some.
Well, let's see. Like in the East Bay, there was the Uptones, so that was a fairly close band.
Okay, didn't know them. No.
Untouchables in L.A.
Oh yeah, Untouchables. We opened for the Untouchables in Arcata.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. I think we had their first record or something. But yeah, Untouchables. Also, there was a band from somewhere in Northern California called the Crazy Eights.
Yeah, they're from Portland.
Oh, they are. Okay, yeah. I think we opened for them once. Yeah.
Interesting. Untouchables, they're such a like, they dress cool. They dance cool. They got scooters. It's funny to imagine Mr. Bungle, the energy you guys bring to the stage prior to that, their performance.
Yeah, I have no idea what the hell they're doing. Yeah. I have a photo on my refrigerator of me holding my niece. So when she was like, I mean, this must be like an 87 or something. And, I've got a mohawk and I'm wearing an Untouchable shirt.
Oh, nice. Going back a bit before Mr. Bungle, you and Mike Patton had a band called Fiend.
Yeah. Yeah. Which was a cover band. It was a metal band. It was already in existence, and then they kicked out their singer and then asked me and Patton to join. But I actually was playing, I was rhythm guitar, which I wasn't. I mean, I kind of played guitar. I wasn't very good, but I mean, it wasn't a very good band. But all we did was we basically played the first Metallica record, probably every song on that record, and maybe a couple Slayer tunes and Armored Saint. And then me and Patton started trying to introduce punk songs into the band, and the other guys weren't having it because there was a very thick fence between punk and metal in those days.
Yeah.
And so they ended up kicking us out. and then right after that, we met Trey and started Mr. Bungle.
So Trey had a band called Torture. Was that band?
Yeah.
Did he dissolve that band and started Mr. Bungle, or did he sort of merge it with the Mr. Bungle?
He kind of merged because it was basically a duo with him and Jed. And sometimes they had a bass player, but sometimes they didn't. And so basically, yeah, Torture and like me and Patton left Fiend, and then met, you know, hooked up with Trey and Jed, and then I think Torture ceased to exist after that. But that was Trey's kind of, you know, metal compositions. I don't really remember what they sounded like, but that song Bungle Grind was Trey's tune, and it was probably in that vein of writing, I guess, you know, like harmonically, you know. That's the thing, when I met Trey and heard him play for the first time, I'm like, wow, nobody plays like this. He's like the Eddie Van Halen of Eureka High School, you know.
At this time when you have these pre-Bungle bands going into Bungle, the first tape, did you guys think of yourselves as metalheads or?
Yeah, well, yeah, definitely. Me and Patton met in junior high, and basically because we both realized we were into heavy rock and metal and stuff, you know, in the early 80s, actually, like 81, 82, and we started trading records. We were really into that movie Heavy Metal and the soundtrack, which was huge because it was a really diverse soundtrack. You know, it had Devo and Blue Oyster Cult, and you know, it wasn't really metal music, but it was the beginnings of metal, you know. And and then, you know, me and Patton at a certain point we decided we hated everyone and decided to grow our hair long. Like, we consciously made that choice. Like, let's do it. Let's do it this summer. Let's start this summer. And then, you know, we'd be comparing like, oh man, it's almost down at the nape of my neck. Oh. And then, yeah, as metal progressed, we kind of progressed. Like we were kind of glam, sort of a little bit glam for a minute. And then it got more into like, then when Metallica happened, basically we're like, you know, started wearing leather and denim But also we were kind of, we were open-minded, so we were also into punk bands, you know, which not a lot of metalheads were. So we were getting into DRI and Discharge and COC, you know, all the bands that we've been covering in the last couple of years, those are the bands that we were listening to at the same time, you know, and basically riding the wave of metal as it was getting more and more aggressive and darker, you know, and until Slayer just like destroyed everything.
But also you were interested in, you know, Oingo Boingo and Fishbone. I mean, these were
even
less metalheads, I think, at that time were interested in these types of bands than even punk.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, we'd write logos, you know, get a Sharpie and we'd write logos all over our jackets and stuff. And I remember having, you know, like a big possessed logo on my jacket. And then also like a Fishbone, you know, the Fishbone symbol. We were, you know, we got to a certain point where we were unapologetic about it. You know, we're just like, man, this is all great, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were listening to like, you know, I was really into the Police at that time. And, which definitely has some, you know, ska elements, you know, those guys
sure.
being British and, you know, coming from that. And Madness was another band, obviously has to be mentioned in this conversation. You know, it's funny. I kind of went down a rabbit hole not too long ago watching old Madness videos, and man, they're still great. The sense of humor those guys have, you know, and the awkwardness that they embrace is really, I think that's something that attracted us too. You know,
I always love how like, I don't know what the right word is. They're extremely British and they very much like flaunt that.
Yeah.
And as an American, like some of it makes sense, some of it doesn't, but you appreciate it regardless.
Yeah. 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 It's kind of like Monty Python, you know, it's like, mm-hmm. it's kind of why, I mean, I don't know, as an American, it's really hard to take a British accent seriously.
Yeah.
You know, even on your first tape, you know, as if you were to view the first tape, the you know, Easter Bunny as a metal record, it's still kind of a weird metal record.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it feels like even at that point, you're pushing the boundaries of metal and, you know, this sort of genres at the time.
Yeah. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that me and Treya were getting, you know, we were, again, kind of learning about harmony and composition. So we were really, I mean, those tunes, that's essentially why we decided to re-record, because we still kind of had this fondness for those tunes, because they're, you know, there's a lot of compositional elements there. We're messing around with theme and variation and intervallic relationships and all this geeky stuff, you know, that you do as a composer. When you sit down and you write notes, you're like, oh, how can I get the most out of this interval, the relationship of these two notes? How can I vary it and turn it upside down? And so there's a lot of that going on. And, I mean, I guess, you know, we never really considered that it was, not necessarily the right way to write metal, you know, or the correct way to do it, you know? But then also we were in the, like bands like Merciful Fate, which is a lot of their stuff is really, it's very riff oriented, but it's complex too, you know, there's a certain complexity there that, that we appreciated. And, yeah, you know, of course they're like Danish, you know, so we were listening to, aside from all the American metal bands that were happening, we were also, you know, partly because Patton worked at this record store, we had access to all this stuff. He's like, oh, there's this new band from, you know, bumfuck Germany, you know, like, let's check that out. Like, oh yeah, let's write that logo on our jackets before anyone else hears this record so we can look like we're super cool.
We'll be right back after this.
Some of the interviews I've read with you and Trey and stuff talk about, you know, being in Humboldt County in the 80s was like kind of like this weird isolated bubble.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like listening to you now, it sounds like you simultaneously you were connected to this world through the record store, through these sort of tape exchange things happening. So it seems like you were sort of isolated, but also connected in this like distant way to the greater world of like alternative music.
Yeah, it's still, you know, that area, Humboldt County in general, is still isolated. I mean, it just kind of physically is, and that affects the culture. And, you know, for us, I mean, thank God we were born with curiosity, you know, and I think that's why Trey and Mike and I like just naturally converged, because we were curious about this other stuff, you know, listening to college radio or, you know, going down the record store and finding stuff that was like scary or unfamiliar and being curious about it. But also we had to, if we wanted to go see any big shows or go to like a big record store, we had to drive down to San Francisco, which we did a lot. We'd go down there to see shows and you know, you had to search for it, you know. And then when Trey and I started going to college, you know, and getting into like 20th century classical music and stuff, you know, you still had to like search for it. You had to go to the library and look this stuff up and find the B-sides of these rare composers that no one's telling you about, you know. And you know, I always feel super fortunate that we had that curiosity to just venture out, you know, because a lot of people, you know, they don't, and they end up staying up there, and which, you know, I'm not judging that, but I'm really glad that that didn't happen to me.
I found this interview that I think it was you and Trey did in the 90s, early 90s, called Guest List. And you guys are both wearing these insane masks.
Oh, is it like in Australia or something?
I don't know, but it's like, there's like a 5-minute clip on YouTube, and they're playing video of Travolta. So it must've been in promotion of that record, which is really funny. And I think it's you. One quote is like, "We came from Humboldt County. We came from the Planet of the Apes TV show." That's what they told us. There's a church of the Planet of the Apes in Humboldt County.
Yeah, that was just some non sequitur.
Yeah.
We used to be pretty irreverent during our interviews.
Sure. Yeah, you're also talking about Robert Tilton.
Oh yeah,
in that interview, and consensus reality.
Yeah. Tilton was also a huge influence on us. We were obsessed with that guy for a long time.
How come?
Just the surrealism of it, you know, the way he spoke in tongues, and we would literally watch that for hours. We'd put it on and try to learn his language, and it was just the bizarreness of the whole thing.
I love that. I love, like, it's like almost like you're broadening the idea of alternative culture. Yeah. To go beyond just like weird bands, but like just weird pieces of culture intended to be weird or not.
Yeah, that, you know, that, I think we got into him after we all left Humboldt County. Well, sort of around the same time. Patton left before us. And then we all started kind of filtering down there. And by the early 90s, we all lived in San Francisco. And that was, you know, the big city for us. And that's when we really kind of, our curiosity blossomed. And, you know, because we were, first of all, there were so many record stores. You know, we'd go to Berkeley, and we'd spend an afternoon shopping at Amoeba, Tower, Virgin. We'd go to Cody's bookstore, you know, we'd just go bananas, you know. And then exploring all this different kinds of music and all the bands in San Francisco, and but also the weird culture, you know. And like, you know, we're old enough to go into porn shops and buy our own whatever weird porn that was, you know, just like the weirdest stuff we could find. We'd just buy that stuff. like, wow, the human race is weirder than we even imagined, you know? And then, yeah, why not? Robert Tilton, you know, evangelist from Texas, you know, like, that's weird too. Let's get into that.
So the name Mr. Bungle, it originated from a 1950s educational film, which I think is sampled on the first record, right?
Yes. Yeah.
But wasn't And it's like, it means like a problem child or, you know, something like that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it actually goes back further, which I haven't really looked into this, but someone was telling me that I think there's like the philosopher Bertrand Russell. I think that's who it is. Talks about the character of the Mr. Bungle in one of his philosophical books, which I haven't checked that out, but I think that term goes further back, and you know, but with this kind of same general meaning as this, you know, this blundering clown figure, you know, in whether it's in our, you know, I don't know how Jungian you want to get, but it's you know, it's this character that is part of society, but also within each of us, you know. I mean, we never went that deep with it. We learned about it from the Pee-wee Herman show. So
yeah, that was what I was going to ask. So that you're where you found out about it, because I've seen that clip too.
Say, another mic. Do you know what a Mr. Bungle is?
Why no?
A Mr. Bungle is somebody who has terrible manners. You know what time it is right now?
Oh yeah, it's time for my next break.
Mm-hmm. It's time for the zoo about having bad manners.
Miss Brown said it was time for the children who ate in the cafeteria to go to lunch. She hoped there weren't any Mr. Bungles in this room.
You saw it on Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Well, it was actually not the Playhouse. It was he did a show. It was a stand-up show he did in L.A.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was on. I think it was on. It must have been on HBO or something.
Yeah, HBO. Yeah.
You know, that was back in the day when you had one cable channel. You know, we just had HBO, and then we had regular TV, you know, and I mean, I saw a lot of great R-rated movies on HBO when I was like 13, you know, and I was obsessed. I remember I was in junior high and I was obsessed with that that Pee-wee show. I think it was just called the Pee-wee Herman show, and it's, you know, it was kind of the precursor to the Playhouse. It's a little more adult themed, I guess.
Yeah.
Also just super bizarre, you know, and then, you know, I kind of found out about who that guy was, that, you know, Paul Rubens, and realized he's in like some Cheech and Chong movies, you know. he's in, I don't know if you've seen those, but I think he's in Up in Smoke and Cheech and Chong's next movie. And he plays he's not Pee Wee Herman, but he's kind of a weirder version of that. But I remember I taped with my, I had a little Sanyo cassette, like little boom box, and that could record. And I remember I recorded that, the Pee Wee Herman show, and I would listen to the audio of it. And, I could probably sit down with that show and, you know, lip sync to it the whole time. But, I was obsessed with that show, and I think that's where the idea of the name Mr. Bungle came up.
Whenever I've listened to the first record and any of the samples come up where they use the word Mr. Bungle.
Uh-huh.
So even understanding all this, it still weirds me out. Like, I still feel like you guys are manipulating reality somehow. Like, how are they doing this? How are they making these people talk about Mr. Bungle in the past? That's how it feels.
Yeah.
It's just like, I just don't think Mr. Bungle. I mean, Mr. Bungle is you guys, like, is a band.
Right, right.
It's not a term used in the 50s.
You know? Right. Well, you know, if you became a member of the Church of the Planet of the Apes, then you might have been more.
So your first show as Mr. Bungle was at the Bayside Grange,
I think
in 85.
And you've done your research.
Yeah. Second of two bands, but the first band was a one-man Christian metal act.
Yeah, Mike Bridges. He was a friend of ours, definitely pretty severely on the spectrum, you would say, nowadays. Really kind of odd guy that we went to high school with. And he was kind of a metalhead, but at some point decided he was born again, and he started playing what he called white metal, and it was very preachy. And he had this white what do you call those? Like a destroyer. I think that was the style of the guitar.
A real angular looking guitar.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, he would play to a cassette or something of a drum machine. And he would sing about, you know, man, I wish Trey was here. Trey recorded his demo and, Trey knew it a little bit better than the rest of us, but he was that guy. He unfortunately passed away not that long ago. So,
oh.
Yeah, I there was probably like 4 or 5 bands on that bill.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like $5 to get in for like 5 bands.
this mid-80s little like newspaper clipping about Mr. Bungle said that your shows were wild and that you can expect them to go into the Howdy Doody theme song or wear Big Loaf bread bags on their head.
Yeah. Big Loaf was a local bread company. And one day we randomly found a box. I guess it must have been near the factory in Eureka or something. We found this box laying on the sidewalk of full of these plastic bags that they would put the loaves of bread in. And it has this big, like red, it said Big Loaf, you know, we're like, oh my God, look at this great free stuff. Let's do something. So yeah, we did. There's one of our early photo shoots where just like, put them on our arms and on our heads. And then, we went to a show and so we'd throw them out of the audience and try to get people to wear them somehow. Like totally ridiculous. We went to a thrift shop once every show we were going to throw something into the audience. And that didn't last very long, but one of the shows we went to like a thrift, store and bought a bunch of underwear and like bras and we threw those out of the audience.
I like the idea of instead of the audience throwing the underwear at the stage, it's you guys throwing it back in the audience.
Yeah.
How did the mask, you guys wearing masks, or how did it start and then how did it evolve? Because by the time the record was out and you guys are a known band, you guys are playing shows in these scary masks.
Yeah. I remember when we were first rehearsing, probably for our first show, probably for that show at Bayside Grange, which was in November, so it was right after Halloween. I remember we were rehearsing and at our drummer's house in his barn. It was actually a barn or something behind his house, and there was this monkey mask sitting there, and I just remember deciding to wear that. At our first show, I probably just wore it for the first song or something, but I think we definitely, you know, again, with the tongue in cheek thing, we were a metal band, but we also were kind of like the idea of making fun of metal, like not taking it too seriously. Cause a lot of, especially at that age, these kids, you know, kids were very competitive and like, you know, there were other metal bands that were like, they were so serious, you know, about what they were doing. And we were just wanted to take the piss out of it. So I think that was maybe kind of one of the first examples of that. And then, so we started doing it a little bit more and more. And then I'm kind of speaking on behalf of the band here, but one of the bands that we used to play with in the Bay Area was the Deli Creeps.
I remember them. Yeah. Which
included Buckethead. And he became a friend of ours. And, you know, I remember watching them live and, you know, just being blown away that he never took the mask off. And it created such a, it created such a vibe, you know. It was really like, who is this person? Like, who is, you know, what it creates this mystery and this almost this sort of like occultism, for a lack of better term, that you like this unreachable thing that's out there. It's like the other, you know? And that was very appealing to us. And I think after that, after playing with those guys a couple times, we decided, man, we got to not take our masks off. And then we started getting really into masks, and we'd go, you know, to like these Halloween shops and just buy all kinds of weird shit, you know? And so then that's what we did for our, you know, our first tour in 92, our first real tour when we toured the States in 92. And then I guess again later we kind of did that after Disco Volante came out too. But yeah,
in the 90s, like the masks you guys wore are real unsettling. Like, it's not really funny. That's what's cool about them. They're like really like kind of disturbing, especially if you watch you guys playing and rocking out in the expression on the mask at the same time is just, you know, bothersome in a way.
Yeah. We like the idea of, you know, messing with the crowd and, you know, I mean, it was kind of this reaction a little bit to, you know, bands like Motley Crue or like glam metal, where it's, you know, you're standing with one foot on the monitor and the fan is blowing your hair back, you know, which we just found ridiculous. And at a certain point we realized that, you know, you kind of have this power on stage, you know, you're in command of this audience and you can kind of do whatever you want up there. Our attitude, I think, was also like, look, we didn't promise that we were going to play all of the songs off our record or any of the songs. We just advertise that we're playing, you know, you buy the ticket and you get what you get, you know. I mean, there's my attitude about that has changed a little bit over the years. Like, yeah, come on, you know, you gotta, you know, I'm a fan of the, you know, if I go see a band I'm into, I want to hear something I know, you know, but I'm also open-minded. I'm like, well, if they decide to do something totally out to lunch, that's cool too, you know? So, but yeah, we were definitely pushing that, I think.
I mean, sometimes that's the best shows or at least the shows that like stick in your memory for longer periods of time, like the time the band did something totally unexpected, or maybe even at the moment you were like kind of disappointed because they didn't do the thing you wanted.
Yeah.
But then like you remember that show for like years.
Yeah. And we would definitely feed off the audience. Like if the audience was getting angry and yelling for songs that we knew we weren't going to play, we would fuck with them harder. You know, we would just be like, oh, you're calling the shots. You're the ones making requests. Okay, well, how about this? How about 10 minutes of feedback, you know? I mean, you know, the Melvins, I think, were a big influence on that too. I remember seeing them in San Francisco at, what was that place called? The Oasis, I think. Was that the place that had the swimming pool that they would cover up with like it basically became the dance floor. They would cover up the swimming pool and, it was right across the street from the Paradise, on like 9th Street or something. Anyway, I remember one of the first times I saw the Melvins, they opened with like, I don't know, it was like Karma Karma Cat or something like that. But it started with just horrendous noise for like 10 minutes. And I remember standing there in the audience just being blown away. I'm like, this is insane. What the fuck is going on, man? But it commanded so much power and control, you know. You as an audience member, you're just like subjugated, you know.
Sometimes you just got to weed out the audience member.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think as as Bungle were kind of going through the 90s, you had this filtration system of like curious Faith No More fans checking out Mike's other band,
right?
So there was this whole. And, you know, I mean, some of them, I'm sure, were like blown away and became huge Mr. Bungle fans. Some did not.
Yeah, which is fine.
Was in relation to this, the masks and the kind of the mystery of who you were, was any of that ever inspired by the Residents?
Not really. I don't think so. Not for me. I sort of missed them, you know. And they were, I think in general, they were probably over our heads. You know, I've since gone back and checked them out and, you know, appreciate them now, which, but I think at that time that they weren't, they just weren't on our radar for whatever reason.
So you talked earlier about how Mike Patton kind of basically strong armed Warner Brothers into signing Mr. Bungle.
Yeah.
Do you recall like having any meetings with them, or what did they have any expectations, or was it because of the arrangement with Mike? It was like, you guys do whatever you want. We don't care.
That was basically it. Yeah. We didn't, you know, we negotiated like a 6 or 7 album contract, but each one was on option, which meant that they had, you know, they would decide if they wanted to pick us up again for each record, you know. And I think the only reason they did was, again, because they thought that, you know, especially after when, you know, I don't know, they started hearing our stuff, and like when stuff like the California came out, it's like, oh, they're getting more melodic. Like maybe there is a hit coming here, you know, maybe they can make us a lot of money. But we always thought that if we ever did a fourth record for Mr. Bungle, it was going to be like unlistenable noise, just like 70 minutes of just like horrendous noise music. And which unfortunately, you know, we never got the chance to do. But one of the great things about being on that label was they just didn't give a shit. I mean, we had an A&R guy for a while, but you know, they never bothered us when we were making records. They didn't, you know, we would basically work on our own. We'd choose the engineer. We decided to produce things ourselves, you know, after the first record. I mean, we chose Zorn to help us with the first record, and then afterwards we just did it ourselves. They never had any say in any of that. They didn't seem to want it. And they never pressured us. We would deliver the record when it was finished, you know, which was amazing. I mean, we had, you know, we had like $100,000 budget for each of those records to do whatever we wanted with, you know, and we spent it all. You know, we like, I mean, the first record, I think we had some left over and we ended up buying some gear. That's when we first were able to actually buy some good amps and stuff. And then, yeah, Disco Volante in California, we like evaporated that money.
Did they ever promote them or do anything like try to get you on MTV or anything? Or was it sort of like, we'll fund the records, we'll put them out, you guys do whatever?
I don't think they did much. They, I remember they offered us tour support, but we actually chose not to take it because we knew we'd have to pay it back. You know, when we did the video for Travolta, MTV rejected it because it was too, you know, it was too dark for them, I guess. I think it was the scene where Patton's dressed up like the Pope with a S&M mask on. I think that was the scene that did it.
But there's also scenes where people are like hanging from the ceiling as well.
Yeah, yeah. That was actually us. That was the band. We wanted to, the idea was to make it look like we were hanging from nooses, but they whoever we were working with wasn't comfortable with us tying ropes around our necks. So
like, come on. Wonder why.
Which, yeah, that definitely would not have even, that definitely would not have been shown on MTV. But, you know, they didn't have our backs in that, I don't think, in any way. So they did very little to promote, yeah.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
John Zorn, can you tell the story about how you guys got him to produce the record? Because if I understand correctly, he took a little convincing, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah. We well, you know, because we had a budget, we started talking about getting a producer for the first time, and a couple names came up. Frank Zappa came up, and Patton actually had a connection to him because the drummer in Faith No More was dating Moon Unit at the time, and so we were kind of able to like indirectly you know, ask him if he'd be interested in producing, and he basically politely turned us down. He said he was too busy, you know, and that was only like a couple of years before he died, I think. And we weren't necessarily Zappa fans. We weren't like, we just kind of felt like he would get us, you know. Supposedly, I don't know if this is true or not, but supposedly after the record came out, he heard it and said that he wished he'd been responsible for it. So I don't know where I heard that from or how true it is, but I, you know, I like to say that, tell people that once in a while.
Yeah, it's a good thing to say.
And then the other person we thought of was Thomas Dolby, believe it or not.
Oh yeah.
And he was like half the budget, so we decided we couldn't afford that. And then, you know, at that same time, we were all getting into we were really in a Naked City, the first Naked City record, and I was also checking out New York bands, you know, like contemporary jazz groups, like this guy Tim Byrne, who's an alto player who's been in New York for a long time. He's got a bunch of bands, and started realizing, oh, that he plays with this guy, this drummer Joey Barron. That's also the drummers on the Naked City record. And then, oh, who's this guy Fred Frith? And you know, we're checking out all these different kinds of music. And then I think Zorn was in San Francisco playing with a band, and I think Trey and Danny went to see him and met him and kind of, you know, got his contact, and we sent him a tape. You know, it was the weirdest thing. It wasn't even a demo. We sent him a tape of us like jamming, like improvising in our rehearsal. We used to actually rehearse in a converted chicken coop that had like 5-foot ceilings. You couldn't even stand up in the place. You had to like duck down. We'd sit down and practice in this chicken coop in this weird little like beach community in Eureka. Very super white trash, really kind of sketchy place. And anyway, we recorded ourselves like improvising for like an hour. And I mean, incidentally, a lot of the song Dead Goon came out of that improvisation. But anyway, we sent that tape to Zorn. He was into it. And then we said, yeah, we want you to produce our record. And he's like, oh, you know, he knew it was for Warner Brothers. So he's like, look, you guys, you don't want me. I'm not a commercial guy. Like I'm not, you know, and we're like, no, that's not what we're doing. We don't want to, this is not going to be a commercial record. We're going to do what we want to do, you know? And so we convinced him to, he basically showed up after the record was recorded and helped us mix it. He was there for like, I think it took us like a song a day to mix it. So it was like 2 weeks. Like him and David Bryson, our engineer, who was the guy who recorded OU818. We specifically wanted him to engineer the album because we really liked working with him. Those guys, him and Zorn, would work on the record during the day, like during the early part of the day, and then we'd show up, you know, in the afternoon and give our 2 cents and yeah, that's how that worked. And immediately after that, Zorn started hiring us different, you know, us as individuals for different projects, you know, and I still work with him to this day, you know, because of that.
I would say that you guys lucked out not getting Frank Zappa because Frank Zappa, I'm a fan of him, but his vibe is different.
Yeah.
He's like kind of sarcastic, a little bit like heady, jazzy stuff. But John Zorn really taps into those sort of unsettling moments really well. And I think that was really emphasized on your record. And that's like something that was always really good about it and something that really makes it hold up to this day.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool to hear. Yeah. I mean, we, you know, Zorn really let us, he wasn't like an aggressive producer type or something. He really was like, hey, I have this idea. I think you should do this. What do you think? You know? And if we nixed it, he would be fine with it. But I mean, one thing he did help us with, it was he like, you know, there was a song where you're using like a fake B3 organ, you know, like a horrible, like 80s synth version of a B3 organ. He's like, you got to get rid of that and you got to get a real B3 organ in here. So we rented a B3 organ and, you know, with a Leslie cabinet and he pushed our, you know, Bear, our saxophone player, to like really get better solos out of him. And you know, he helped us make the music more authentic. Cause we were just a bunch of kids who had no idea what we were doing. We're like, yeah, we've got one keyboard, you know, and, you know, these tiny little PV amps, you know? So he kind of helped authenticate the music somehow.
Yeah. One of the things that I really like about the record is that there's moments when the songs where it's funny, like, you know, like this, and I think it's an egg where you're going, no place like home, no place like home, over and over and over and over again. Like, it's funny. No then there'll be moments where, you know, there's like these little quiet moments and like Mike is like whispering something you can't quite understand. And that kind of makes you feel, it's not funny. You know, it shifts your feeling about it. Like who are these guys? What are they doing? Is this supposed to be funny? I can't tell if it's supposed to be funny. Like it can really ride that line with the record.
Well, I think a lot of that just comes from growing up in Eureka, you know. I mean, there's definitely, and that attitude, you know, is a thread that goes through all of our records, that is, there's just, you know, this kind of dark underbelly, you know, and just kind of being aware of it, you know, but hopefully not being completely sucked into it like some people are, you know, becoming like drug addicts and whatnot, or, you know, criminals, you know. But we always had this sort of motto that we've never really, I'm sure we've said it out loud to people, but we always used to say aim to confuse. I think Trey came up with that somehow. but yeah, that was always sort of our motto, just aim to confuse. And you know, to this day, I love being confused by, you know, art, by music and whatever. I'm like, if I don't understand something and I'm like, you know, I have to, you know, do a double take and be like, what the hell is going on here? Like, that's what intrigues me. You know, that makes me want to take a deeper look and like learn something from it. You know, doesn't mean I have to like it or attach myself to it in any way, but I can, you know, I can choose to or not, you know, but at least I can, you know, I'm not just like going through the motions and being habitual and, you know, routine and all that stuff, which is such a, you know, it's kind of a sad state that humans, we get ourselves into a lot. And, you know, of course I'm, not above it, you know, and it happens to me too, but, you know, being aware of it and being open-minded enough to like learn something from somewhere else was always important to us. So yeah, I think it's not like we ever sat down and discussed this as a philosophy or something. It just happened naturally. And luckily we all kind of were on the same page most of the time, you know, about that kind of stuff. It's like Disco Volante. We didn't discuss what kind of record we were going to make. We just all started writing and that's what happened, you know. Same with California. We didn't decide to make like a quote unquote pop record or, you know, write more melodically. We just all naturally, Trey and Mike and I mostly, Bear more so towards the end, but, or during California, he wrote more. He wrote a lot of important shit on California actually. But you know, those attitudes and the direction of the music and what we were doing, it just for whatever reason, magically just happened.
I'm really surprised to hear you say that you did not use your entire budget on the first record, because it sounds like you guys were in the studio for so long working on that record. The attention to detail and all the little studio Easter eggs and the complexity of the compositions. I'm curious about it, cause I've always wondered how much of this record was created in the studio?
Everything was written before we went in. I think Dead Goon was like the last song that Mike essentially arranged, but kind of based on this improvisation I was talking about. And then there was like Danny wrote that the famous bass line in that song that everyone always asked me about. Danny, our drummer, actually wrote that. So that was kind of Mike kind of took all these elements from different parts and kind of put together this song and wrote the lyrics for it. That was like the last, I think in the last couple months before we went into the studio, that song was written. But everything else, we'd already been playing live, and we rehearsed the shit out of it before we went in the studio because we wanted to do it as efficiently as possible. And so, you know, we rehearsed everything and then recorded. We got basic tracks, which is basically the drums and the bass. We tried to get those down as quickly as possible. So we would do like one or two takes, and you know, we were working with tape, so we couldn't do a lot of editing. And so I think we probably did the basic tracks in the first 2 days. And then we just started going crazy with overdubs, you know, and getting the guitar parts down, and then you know, horns and vocals and percussion, and then started throwing stuff on top, you know, which was always our, that kind of became the, you know, we were the kids in the candy store when it came to that. We're like, oh man, there's space here for a shaker. Let's put something in there, you know, and let's add, you know, a synth over here. And, it just got fun to do that, you know? And, but so that was, I think that I feel like we, the whole record was done in a month. I kind of feel like we recorded it in 2 weeks and then took 2 weeks to mix it. If I'm not mistaken. But I mean, that's all we were doing. You know, we weren't screwing around in the studio like a lot of bands do. You know, a lot of bands with these budgets, I mean, I only know this because I've heard stories about, you know, they're just sitting around partying and, you know, the producer's like clipping his toenails and the band is like doing lines of coke and nothing's getting done and the record company's paying for it. It's like, no, we went in there, we'd show up, work all fucking day until, you know, order burritos for lunch and keep working and then work until we were exhausted and go to sleep and get up and do it again. I mean, we were living and breathing that, like we basically did all of our records that way. I mean, California was more, mm-hmm. It took longer and we skipped around to different studios, you know, and it wasn't, we'd had to take time off while people were doing other stuff, in between sessions. But, essentially when we were in the studio, it was like nothing but being in the studio.
I read an interview. It might've been with Trey. I can't remember, but, he was talking about that your songs aren't really like one person writes a song, that they're everybody's sort of like adding and building, and it's like almost like Legos, like building a Mr. Bungle song.
Yeah. Well, that, I think that kind of happened more in the beginning. Like with the first record, we would kind of get together and jam and work stuff out together. And, you know, we have this thing called the graveyard of riffs. And if someone had a riff that they weren't using, they'd put it in the graveyard and anyone could cannibalize it at any time. And someone would be like, hey, I'm going to use this. I got a place for this in my song, you know, and that, you know, that did happen on all the way up through California. But I think it happened mostly in the beginning. And then as we went on, we kind of got a little more separatist, you know, and would come in with like each individuals come in with a finished song. Like, here's my song. Here's how I want it to go. I mean, there was always room for adjustment, you know. As an example, that song, Vanity Fair on California, was something that I originally wrote, this kind of slow, almost, like Marvin Gaye kind of groove with a saxophone line. And I didn't know what to do with it. So I was like, hey, Patton, you know, do something with this. And then he like sped it up and turned in this kind of like almost Michael Jackson-y doo-wop thing, you know? So that's, you know, an example of how something like that could work.
Now, did you, you were the person that recorded all the samples for the first record?
No, Trey did. Trey had a portable DAT player, a DAT machine. And, I mean, there were some specific stuff. Well, actually, I did record, I had a cassette player and I used to, that had a, it was a little, I forget what it's called, but it was like a Sony like D6 or something. And it had this little stereo compressor mic. And, I, you know, I got really obsessed with recording, you know, quote unquote field recordings in Eureka, you know, and I'd hear like street fights and I'd immediately turn it on, you know, and, and then, you know, we used to hop the freight train in town, and that whole train sequence is from my recording on that cassette player. Mm. But then when we went to the studio, Trey had this DAT machine and him and Mike went out and recorded like for that song Stub a Dub, there's some screeching car tires that were actually was Trey like driving down the street in Eureka and like skidding to I don't know where they did that. It was probably in some dark alley in Eureka somewhere, like, okay, you gotta, you know, speed up to like 90 miles an hour and then slam on the brakes right by the DAT machine. So yeah, and then like a lot of the pinball samples, the sounds from pinball machines were from this arcade that we used to hang out at, and Trey recorded those. You know, they, I think him and Mike would just go, they just go play the pinball machines until we got the right samples.
I was at an arcade once in the 90s, and I started playing a pinball machine, and it was the one that you guys sample.
Oh yeah. Comp.
Yeah. I didn't know it was, but I was playing it and I was like, oh my God, what's going on?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was Common. I think that was just called. Yeah.
So the song, so Travolta, actually I'd read that Trey had written that song initially as like a big band jazz song, and that Mike Patton had like brought in some like weird, some of that weird metal stuff at the end. And that's kind of how the song took shape initially.
Huh. I think that might be a conflation of a couple different stories, because there is, I mean, I don't totally remember all of this. Actually, that's Patton wrote that song. And I think he pretty much, if I'm not mistaken, I think he wrote everything in that song. Maybe Trey wrote some riffs. I honestly don't remember, but there was, Trey wrote a song for the big band when that me and him were he and I were in, actually Danny was in that band too, in college at Humboldt State. And, I kind of feel like those were some of the riffs that ended up in None of Them Knew They Were Robots, which also has like a Patton bass line from an earlier like version of a song or something. So I don't really remember how that all got put together, the song Travolta, but I remember the concept of the lyrics, how that got, that came from us driving up late one night after a gig in San Francisco. You know, we had to drive, we'd play in San Francisco and then drive all 4 hours to get back to Humboldt because we had class in the morning. And I remember just having this like delirious conversation about, we just made up this character. Like, what if there was a guy who had no arms or legs, and his only sense that he had, you know, he was blind and deaf, but he could still smell. That was the only sense that he had. So he's this like basically this blob on this table that, and his dream is to be a dancer. That's the story. And so then Patton wrote those lyrics based on that.
The song, it's called Travolta, and then it becomes quote unquote.
Yeah. Right after the record was released, like I think the first pressing came out of, I don't know, however many records, 20,000 or something, whatever Warner Brothers did. And then all of a sudden they were like, oh wait, you can't call the song Travolta because it might get, you know, it might be considered defamation of character and we'll get sued or something, which it's not. It's about a character who dreams of being Travolta, of being John Travolta, because he dances in almost every one of his movies. And so we had to change the name, and that, and for some reason that, I don't even remember how that happened, but quote unquote came up. So I think that was a reference that we were hearing a lot during, like, you know, when we were reading our contract, our like, you know, 900 page contract with Warner Brothers, like quote unquote, you know.
So during the session, I feel like, you know, you're really seeing Mike Patton, really hearing the range of his vocals in this, you know, from everything from singing to screaming to doing the sounds. Was this where he really starts to go in this direction, or was that already happening before then?
I think it was happening before then. Yeah. I mean, you know what's funny is, I mean, if you listen to those early demos, like, he really doesn't have much of a voice.
Yeah.
He always had a really good ear. And listened to a lot of music, you know, but his voice wasn't very strong. And then, you know, he went on tour with Faith No More for like 2 years straight and came back, and like, it was like he'd been at the, you know, it was like his vocal cords had been at the gym like every day. So, which was pretty amazing, you know. I mean, I remember when I first heard the rough tracks of the first Faith No More record that he's on, and just being kind of blown away, you know. First of all, I was recording in a real studio, you know, which we had never done and but also just like the strength of his voice, you know. But he, you know, also again, like listening to, for instance, Yamasuka Ai in Naked City, you know, and kind of getting into more screaming. And I think Diamanda Galas was an influence in that realm, you know, kind of starting to use the voice in a, you know, extended range, you know, that was, and then, you know, it just kind of, for what, you know, kind of came naturally to him, you know? So yeah, his range and his power to do that, you know, I don't think he's ever taken a voice lesson in his life. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. And especially I think the, cause he really went in this direction, just like the experimenting with sounds with his voice.
Yeah. Yeah. And kind of, you know, wanting to be like an, you know, it's almost kind of comes from wanting to be an instrumentalist in a way, wanting to be part of the band and not necessarily like on top of the band, you know, it doesn't have to be the vocals on top of the band. And we all like supported that, you know?
Yeah.
Also listening again, you know, when we were all in San Francisco and exploring different music, like kind of getting into like Exotica, you know, Les Baxter and stuff like that. And, you know, vocal sounds and all this percussion, this kind of different stuff you can do with your voice, you know?
Yeah.
I think that was a big influence too.
I think a good final question, I would be curious about your perspective of the infamous New Year's Eve show in 1992, opening for Primus.
Right, with the Melvins, yeah.
And so the one where Mike Patton, I think he ripped off a Santa boot from a robotic Santa on stage, pissed in it, drank it, and then tossed the rest of the audience.
Actually, I think what happened was we found that Santa. It was like, I think we found it on the street that day. And of course we were like, okay, we have to bring that on stage. There's no question, you know? And, somebody had abandoned this robotic Santa. So, but I think that what happened is some fan threw their shoe up on stage. Mm. And that's what Patton pissed into. And, I mean, that show was kind of a nightmare for us because Primus kind of screwed us out of a sound check. And then only let us use a portion of the board. And, so our sound was horrible and, yeah, I don't really remember a lot of that show. I mean, also that was what, 35 years ago or something. So, but yeah, I guess that was infamous. I think he also that night, for some reason, I think he like split his head open on the stage, which was not uncommon, and had to be rushed to the hospital. And
oh, I think I remember hearing about that. Yeah. Now I wasn't able to go to the show. I wanted to, but I couldn't. But yeah, I mean, that's like all anyone talked about next when we were back in school. Like, oh my God, Mike Patton drank his own piss and threw it in the audience.
I mean, you know, he did a lot of, you know, again, going back to like, you know, our curiosity in about culture in when we all lived in San Francisco, you know, kind of getting into finding out about performance art and you know, what are the limits that you could, you know, what you could push on stage, you know. And he, you know, I don't know, he did a lot of crazy shit back then, you know. I mean, I remember one show, I think it was might have been the previous New Year's, we played at the Kennel Club, that place I was talking about, and he decided to There was like a big garbage can full of bottles, empty bottles that we found backstage. So he brought that out on stage. He put one microphone in the can with the bottles and then proceeded to smash the side of the garbage can with a golf club. This is being amplified through a microphone, you know, probably while we're playing a song. And of course, glass is like shooting up out of the can, flying everywhere. And then he discards the golf club. And it was one of those, I don't know anything about golf, but it was one of those big, it has the wooden base at the end. I don't know,
I think that's a driver. I don't know anything about golf, but yeah.
Yes, that, yeah. But so he throws it, he's finished with it. So he just like tosses it over his shoulder and it comes twirling like end over end towards me. And I just remember looking up and seeing the base of it coming towards me, and it literally hit me in the forehead. And I remember I was wearing like a paper bag over my head with like eye holes. It, for some reason, it hit me in a way that it didn't actually hurt at all. It just like hit me square or something. And it was like, It did. And I just remember looking at Patton and giving him two thumbs up.
Did any of this stuff, like the New Year's Eve show or any of the other stuff that he did it ever shock you guys? Or was it just like, all right, yeah.
Well, a lot of the times I was too busy paying attention to the song to, you know, to even notice what was going on. I mean, after our first tour in 92, when we toured the States, we came home to a pretty hefty damage bill from various clubs, you know, busting out stage lights and throwing monitors into the audience. You know, I mean, there was a lot of tantrum throwing on that tour, partly because we had it in our contract that if they, you know, we were trying to separate ourselves from Faith No More as much as possible. And just because we wanted to be our own entity, you know, we weren't Mike Patton's other band. We were our own band. It was a collective, you know, it wasn't his band. And, you know, certainly he was in Mr. Bungle before he was in Faith No More. So we tried to separate ourselves. So we had this clause in our rider that said that we could refuse the right to play a show if we found out the promoter used Faith No More or Mike's name to promote the show, which was kind of ridiculous because we would show up at venues and they'd be sold out because people knew who we were because of Patton's fame, you know, and him wearing our shirt in the Faith No More video, you know. So there was a positive side to it, but you know, and we're not gonna, you know, it's our first tour. We're excited as hell to be out there, and we're not gonna cancel a show, you know, because of that, you know. There's people there to see us. We want to play. So instead, Patton would throw a tantrum on stage and like break a bunch of shit. And then of course we get home and we're like, oh, here's this bill for like $5,000, you know, that we have to pay for. And like, wait a minute, I didn't break those lights. He did. But you know, whatever. It wasn't like I was stopping him. So.
Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slow Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying ska now more than ever.
Do you still listen to a lot of Mr. Bungle?
I do. It's, you know, from time to time, I'll throw in some Mr. Bungle. About yourself?
Yeah, the California album mostly.
So that's your favorite, the California record?
Yeah, yeah.
Is it because you live in California?
No. It's just the vibe of that record's really cool.
Oh, okay.
So anyhow, that was fun getting to talk to Trevor. And you know what else?
What else?
You could potentially become a Patreon subscriber. You come hang out with us over behind the curtain. We could talk a little bit more. You come check out some of these back episodes we've got. We can just chill. It's a good time. You'll be supporting the podcast.
Sometimes things get a little off the rail behind the curtain, like I don't know. You might even hear us freestyle rap sometimes.
You won't hear us freestyle rap ever. But you should sign up anyways. Hey, you know what though? If you request it in the Patreon, maybe we'll freestyle rap.
Yeah, as in Adam, not me.
Carnes will do it too. He'll try to juggle as well.
I can juggle much better than I can freestyle rap.
Which isn't very good.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.